A number of years ago, I was standing at a street corner in downtown Seattle, back when I was still working, waiting for the light to change in order to cross the street, when a very well-dressed, natty young man said to me, he said, "I like your shoes." And I said, "I do too. They're cool." He says, "Yeah, cool, man." And just about that time, a big Lincoln Continental just happened to drive by, one of these cars you see at a classic car show. The trunk had the typical upright tire encased place, and it had kind of like a Rolls-Royce grill and spoke wire wheels, and I mean, it was really classic. And he said, he looked at that and he says, "Yeah, that's cool too, man." And as he said that, it suddenly dawned on me he had totally misunderstood the context of the word cool, at least in the way I was or had replied to him. He thought that shoes were cool as in hip, you know, the in thing, classy. Or as I learned recently in talking to a friend of mine who has teenagers, I guess the buzzword now or the jargon now for cool or super cool is lit. Now, back when I was a teenager, lit had an entirely different connotation. When you were lit, it wasn't exactly cool, but nonetheless, you know, the jargon changes and the acronyms change as the years go by. In any way, or in any event, I use the word cool because the shoes I was wearing had a real loose weave. They had little strips of leather that were crossways, and it allowed air to come in, and it was really, it kept your feet very cool. And I usually went up to the YMCA and played basketball during the lunch hour, and there's nothing more irritating than to come back to the office and have hot, sweaty feet the rest of the afternoon. As a matter of fact, this particular brand I had found at Nordstrom, it was an Italian name, which I didn't recognize, but I used those shoes for years. I had them resold probably two or three times, but finally, after that length of time and the friction of the strands, you know, going back and forth, they started to wear out, and, you know, pretty soon one would break and another would break, and then you could pretty well discount their use as dress shoes. In any event, I think as teenagers, we've all wanted to be thought of as being cool, as being hip, as we wanted to be accepted. You know, there's a tremendous pressure on teenagers to be accepted at that age, to fit in, to blend, to be accepted, to be part of the group. But you know, that doesn't stop just at the teenage years. It follows us into the adult years of our lives as well. Turn to Matthew 23, verse 13. Matthew 23, verse 13. We're going to look at something and come back to this in just a few minutes. Matthew 23, verse 13. Here Jesus is illustrating a point. He's describing a characteristic, and it's acting as a warning to us as well. Verse 13 of Matthew 23. "But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." And focus on the word hypocrites, because that's what I'm going to emphasize in the next five or six verses. Because every time he talks about the scribes and every time he talks about the Pharisees, he uses this word, hypocrites. Now, these were the learned religious leaders of the day. They were the ones that supposedly understood God's law. They were the ones who studied it. They were the ones who were supposed to interpret it and convey its meaning to the people listening to them. And yet, he tells them, or calls them, hypocrites. Continuing on, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. So, they were purportedly supposed to be teaching the people listening to them, the people in the congregation, about the kingdom of heaven. But they not only were not doing it, because it says, for you neither go in yourselves, neither suffer you them that are entering to go in as well. So, I mean, they weren't doing their job. They themselves weren't qualified to go in as a result of the way they were living. And they were hindering the people they should have been teaching and teaching correctly. And so he said, you know, you're falling down on your job. And the reason is you're hypocrites. You're supposed to be the experts, and yet you're not doing it. You're pretending to be something, and you're not. Verse 14, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees. And once again, we see the word hypocrite used in conjunction with that. For you devour widows' houses. You know, anytime there's a death in the family, particularly of an elderly person, that person is very, very vulnerable. They're by themselves, and particularly a woman who maybe has not had any financial experience that perhaps is not as true nowadays, because women get involved in those types of things a lot earlier. And their parents, if they're doing their job, will help teach them to do this, preparing them for adult life. But back at that time, they were dependent upon their the structure of their community, their church, to help them. And so they would consult with the scribes and Pharisees. You know, what should we do with our home now that our husband's no longer here? You know, what is the correct way of handling this? You know, I don't know anything about it. And so the scribes and Pharisees would take over, and pretty soon it says they devoured the widows' houses, meaning there wasn't anything left after they finished. Maybe they sold them and took the money, part of it, and talked them into giving it to the church. Or the inference here is that it ended up in the pockets of the scribes and Pharisees. And for a pretense, make long prayers. So after they've done this type of thing, they'll stand up and make long, elaborate prayers, which, you know, is the epitome of hypocrisy. Therefore, you shall receive the greater damnation. Matthew 23, verse 23, jumping ahead. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees. And once again, the word hypocrite. For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, these small herbs. You'll pick them out very precisely and scrupulously, count out a tenth. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Nine are mine, and the tenth one goes to God. Looking at these very, very inconsequential minor things, But Jesus said, these ought you to have done. And there wasn't anything wrong with doing them, but as it said before, you've omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. And those are what you should have been doing. You should have been not only preaching judgment, mercy, and faith, but you should have been living it. The widows needed your help, and yet you took their livelihood away. Or in this case, talking about what they were doing as far as tithing. So they were doing one thing when they should have been doing something else. These ought you to have done, and not to leave the other undone, which also shows that they weren't even doing the tithing correctly. It doesn't say exactly why in this particular case, but he says that, you know, you weren't doing that. Maybe they were tithing on these little things and not even tithing on larger amounts. It just doesn't say. Verse 27, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. And here again, that registers that word, what he is associating the scribes and Pharisees as doing. For you're like unto whitened sepulchres, which indeed appear beautifully outward. And you've probably seen these in certain cemeteries, the beautiful marble structure made of white marble, very beautiful, very ornate, with maybe engravings and all these types of things. They're very expensive, so only the wealthy can buy them. So the outside looks great. And he's saying, well, that's what you scribes and Pharisees are like. You look great on the outside. You walk into a cemetery and just are in awe of how beautiful something like that is, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. So he's contrasting, you know, what you see on the outside as opposed to what's actually inside. And that's what the scribes and Pharisees were doing. Being hypocritical, doing one thing, looking and saying one thing on the outside, but inwardly they were full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. And finally, verse 29, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. One final mention of the word. He used that phrase five times in this chapter to give it a special emphasis. I think we all know what a hypocrite is. It's someone who pretends to possess certain virtues or qualities that he doesn't possess or he doesn't have. The scribes and the Pharisees were pretending to be virtuous, pretending to be religious, but it was false, it was fake, it was a, you know, charade. You've heard about this numerous times, and I think we're all very familiar with that concept and know and understand what it means. I'd like to look at another aspect of hypocrisy, which is a little different. It may be something that you may not have thought about in this way, but it nonetheless exists, and that is this. Do we sometimes appear to be less righteous than we actually are? Let me repeat that. Do we sometimes appear to be less righteous than we actually are? You know, because something is popular, do we want to appear to be cool at school or at work or with our friends, and so acquiesce and go along with whatever it is the rest of the crowd is doing? Are we embarrassed to be too, quote, righteous, unquote. Doing the right thing when we should, or don't do it when we're in a different group, and that is definitely another form of hypocrisy. You know, I'm talking about submerging parts of our Christian personality and emphasis on the word Christian. How does that happen, or how does it work? You know, maybe it's as innocuous or subtle or innocent as not speaking up about something that we feel strongly about, because by doing that, it's going to give a religious slant on our approach to something. Because if they ask questions, then you have to defend your statement. You have to explain your statement. So sometimes people don't do that because they don't want to be looked on as outsiders, as pariahs, as outcasts, as being weird or out of step. You know, we're told to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And so there's a certain balance there that you just don't blat out everything. And as it was discussed or described in other parts of the Bible, throw your pearls before swine. But on the other hand, we don't stand out on the street corner like some do, proclaiming that the end of the world is coming. And I think that's the reason the Beyond Today program exists. That's their job. They do it in a very tasteful manner. And they command respect, and they've got credibility for doing it. In our little town of Eatonville, with its one stoplight, every so often, a man stands at the corner of a large parking lot where the only grocery store in town is, holding a banner for world peace. I don't know if he's affiliated with any religious denomination, but there are people I know that don't agree with his method of expression. And nonetheless, he's exercising his right for freedom of speech. So, you know, from that standpoint, it's okay. But we're not asked to do that. Neither, on the other hand, are we told to deny what we believe, as Christ, or as Peter's example, when he denied Christ three times. Every time we present a false outward show, it's a facade, it's a pretense, it's a masquerade. We are lying about who we really are, which is obviously wrong. Over and above that, the real danger is that when we appear to be less righteous than we are or believe we should be, we may become less righteous as a result. The real danger is that you appear to be less righteous, and it very likely follows that you may become less righteous as a result. Turn to 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19. The Apostle Paul talking here, "For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. Unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law, as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law." So he understood where they were coming from. He talked to them using his knowledge of what they believed to establish credibility with them. And then he was able to give him a different story because they respected what he had to say because of his background. Verse 21, to them that are without law, as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. So here again, he came at them from whatever standpoint it was necessary for them to become interested in what he had to say. To the weak, verse 22, became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. So Paul used this method of teaching. He used this method of getting his message across by stating, yes, this was my background. I did this. I persecuted Christians. I was responsible for having Christians killed. I know what I was like. And he went through this type of thing. He had the background, his education, he would bring in where appropriate. Notice the one thing that these verses do not say is this. It doesn't say to the unrighteous, I became unrighteous. It doesn't say that. To the sinner, I became a sinner. It doesn't say that. He may have told them, I was a sinner, but I'm no longer a sinner. But he doesn't say that he was unrighteous. It doesn't say he was a sinner. He wasn't using this principle to justify unlawful actions. You know, I don't know what kind of language he used, but we know that what he did was inspired by God. And because of that, whatever his method was, it was very much influenced by God's Spirit. He was a consummate or perfect salesman when selling the gospel to those mentioned here, the ones that we've talked about. He used the principles that were mentioned to help guide them to the point of conversion. You know, after work, maybe we go out with one of the guys or one of the gals, go out for a drink to be one of them. You know, after all, it won't hurt to have just one drink. But one leads to another, and someone tells an off-color joke, and we smile politely, and then we have a few more drinks. And pretty soon you're dredging up something from your forgotten past because you lose your inhibitions and want to be part of the group. And that's very easy to do. And that is how it can begin. You want to be cool. You want to be accepted because of that desire we all have. So blend in. It should be fairly obvious what the dangers of doing this are. By assuming an attitude of unrighteousness, it soon doesn't take too long for us to become unrighteous. By assuming that attitude, it doesn't take long for us to become that way, regardless of how strong we are or how strong we think we are. You know, it becomes easy to succumb to the dangers that can occur when we put ourselves in the wrong environment. And that's just one example. You know, it can be a bachelorette party. It can be any kind of a place where groups get together. We all want to be accepted, to be liked, to be cool, especially during our teenage years. And the reality is that desire doesn't leave us, but continues to follow us the rest of our lives. There are always consequences when we engage in hypocrisy and pretend to be something other than what we should be. You know, it may come across as a, quote, little white lie, as some people will say, as if to say or try to differentiate between what's important and what isn't important. The reality is that a lie is a lie is a lie, whether you call it white, green, purple, or however you couch it, it is still a lie. And the consequences of lying may not always be immediate, but they are inevitable. For example, I'm going to look briefly at the story of Joshua in the Battle of Jericho. I'm not going to cover the first part of the story because you're all very familiar with that. But let's pick it up in Joshua 6, where Joshua is giving instructions to the people regarding the captured city. Joshua 6, beginning in verse 17. Joshua 6, verse 17. And the city shall be accursed, even it and all that are therein, to the eternal. And only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all that are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And Rahab had made them promise that they, if she helped them, that they would save her. And they were making good on that promise. Verse 18, and you in any wise keep your hands off of everything else. Keep yourselves from the accursed thing, lest you make yourselves accursed. When you take of the accursed thing and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. And now we see what the accursed thing is, because he lists it in verse 19. But all the silver and gold and vessels of brass and iron are consecrated unto the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord. So all of those things, you may look at them, you may admire them, you may like to have them, but don't touch them. Don't keep them. Well, you can touch them to give them to the treasury, but they're not for you to keep. Joshua 6, verse 24. And so here's what they did. They burnt the city with fire and all that was therein. Only the silver and the gold and the vessels of brass and of iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. Beginning in Joshua 7, verse 1. But, a big but the children of Israel committed a trespass in the accursed thing. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed thing, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against the children of Israel. And we see that all it took was one person for this to happen. Just one man caused this to occur. Verse 11. Israel has sinned, and they have also and this is God talking to Joshua. Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded thee, for they have even taken of the accursed thing and have also stolen and dissembled also. So they took what they shouldn't have, they stole it, and they've lied about it, and they've put it even among their own stuff. Verse 12, therefore the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies, but turn their backs before their enemies. So when their enemies, when they were fighting their enemies were quick to take advantage of the fact the only thing they saw were the backs of the Israelites running through the woods, through the forest, down the road, because they couldn't stand against them. They had to flee. And God said, neither will I be with you anymore unless except you destroy the accursed from among you. And so they went through a process of elimination. And finally, in verse 20, and Achan confessed and answered Joshua and said, "Indeed, I have sinned against the Lord God of Israel, and thus have I done. When I saw among the spoils a goodly Babylonian garment," or a Brooks Brothers suit, if we couch it in modern language, "and 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight, then I coveted them." So he lusted after them and took them, and behold, they're hid in the earth in the midst of my tent, and the silver under it. Verse 22, "So Joshua sent messengers, and they ran unto the tent, and behold, it was hid in his tent, and the silver under it." And if you think about this, Achan was the one that committed the sin, but his family knew what was going on, because you don't take something, I mean, I'm not sure what instruments they use, but Achan dug a hole in the middle of the tent. And so everyone in the tent, his children, his wife, knew what was going on. You don't buy a brand new suit and stick it in the ground. Be like you buying one and going out in your backyard and digging a hole and putting your suit in it. That obviously indicated what he was doing was, you know, not right. Anyway, the consequences of that, so Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, and the silver and the garment and the wedge of gold, and his sons and his daughters and his oxen and his asses and his sheep and his tent and all that he had, and they brought them unto the valley of Achor. And Joshua said, "Why hast thou troubled us? The Lord shall trouble thee this day." And all Israel stoned him with stones and burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. So this was the end result of what happened. He lied, he stole. I mean, a consequence of all his actions ended up in his death and the death of his family. So the things we do individually, we may think, well, they'll only affect me. But you don't know the effects it's going to have on your family if and when they find out about something that perhaps you've done. You know, why were they all killed? Well, as an example to the rest of Israel. And as I said, Achan's family was in on this deception. You know, after all, someone might have raised the question as to why was Dad digging a hole in the middle of the tent? You know, was he digging for water? And then when they saw what he did, you know, they knew what had happened. You hang your suits up, you don't bury them. Or maybe they thought the old man's finally gone off the deep end. I don't know. It doesn't tell, of course, but they knew. And as a result of Achan's lust for a new suit and those and the money, it turned his head and cost him and his family their lives. Well, we're familiar with other examples in the Bible of lying. There's certainly plenty of them. There's Ananias and Sapphira in the New Testament. The penalties weren't always as immediate and as dramatic, but they always occurred, and that's the way it is. Sometimes the penalties don't happen right away, but they will occur somewhere along the line. You can count on that. Unless you repent, of course, of what you've done. And even then, sometimes what you did has long-range and lasting effects. You know, in modern Israel, shading the truth or telling white lies is really a way of life. You know, we need to make sure we don't get caught up in that, that we don't let it happen to any of us. Let our yea be yea and our nay be nay. We should not appear to be less righteous than what we're trying to be. We should not appear to be less righteous than what we are trying to be. If we do, we're throwing off a false image of ourselves, which in effect is lying to those around us about who we really are, or who we're trying to be, trying to become. We need to value what righteousness we have and hold fast to it. We shouldn't lose it for the sake of our family, our friends, or coworkers in order to be accepted. You're always going to have a choice. Do I do what's right, or I do what they want me to do, because then I'll be part of the crowd? You know, we shouldn't lose it for the sake of any of the people around us. We should not hide our light under a bushel, because if we do, someday when Christ returns and we walk up to introduce ourselves to him, we may hear him say, "You know, I don't believe I know you. You're just a little too cool, a little too hip, a little too lit for me." We don't want to make that mistake, brethren, so don't let it happen to you.